So on we go with reimagining copyleft. And we say welcome to Femke Snelting from Constant. Constant is a non-profit artist-run organization based in Brussels since 1997 and active in the fields of art, media, and technology. And originally it was announced that she will speak together with Anne Mertens, who unfortunately turned sick, so it's just Femke Snelting alone. Welcome.
Just me. Anne Mertens was supposed to be here because we prefer to speak as a collective, because most of our work is that. Listening to the presentations just before, I realized I'm going to add another layer of layers, so bear with me. I'm trying to keep it simple. I come here with news from Constant, as was introduced, an association for arts and media based in Brussels. This association has been working since the late 90s as the intersection of feminisms, collective practice, and free software. And from this set of intersections, we started to work around the 2000s with a copyright regime that I have summarized as copyleft. So the report I'm bringing you today is from a study day that happened late September, which was called Authors of the Future, Reimagining Copyleft. And I saw in the program it became a kind of a contrast to another talk that is called Reimagining Copyright. But you all understand why it was important to name it this way. 20 years ago, a few things happened. Constant was involved in working with artists like Chris Marker, who famously made La Jetée, artists that were having practices that were based on collage, on bringing together different materials. Constant itself was thinking about what it means to be a feminist artist. What does it mean to credit? What does it mean to understand your practice as essentially webbed, connected, relational? And then we also started to increasingly work with digital media. We understood that artist practice is not separate from technological practice, and we were trying to find a way to think these things together. And then within free software practices, so practices of software development, a certain legal trick started to appear. The trick to actually apply an extra license on top of conventional copyright that would allow you to, as an author, to share your work with others. So you would have to have the legal right on the object, but from then on you could actually decide what you wanted to do with it. And this created a super inspiring environment for discussing what is an author, what does it mean to author, what does it mean to share work, what does it mean to ask permission or not, what does it mean to give permission, who has the right to give permission, etc., etc. So this is the archive that we brought to the event. It was exactly 20 years after our first public commitment to copyleft. The event was called Copy Cult, the original sin sign.
So when we talk about licensing, what happens usually is that it's presented in a very, let's say, mechanical way. Like, you know, it's straightforward. You've got something, and you put a license next to it, and then this is it. And then according to the license, then this thing is able to circulate in some way or another. That's true, and it's like more belong to the legal aspect of this mechanism. But at the same time, these licenses, at least for me, something that is as important is to see that as being basically ideological interfaces. And they are ideological interfaces because they allow a work or an author or a creator or a collective to basically establish a relation between their practice and society. That's step one. But step two, because of the document itself and the way they articulate the condition of circulation, they are also able to share how they envision the transformation of society. So in the end, it's essentially like dealing with politics. So any kind of license, regardless of, you know, like its dryness or its, let's say, its more speculative artistic dimension or activist dimension, is a political element.
So you heard Aymeric Mansou, one of the guests that we invited for this study day. And he is the one that, for example, wrote a text that circulated a lot. My lawyer is an artist. It was just republished by Antonio Roberts, another guest in this event. And Aymeric makes a very important statement, I think, is to say that any license is politics. So they are interfaces between the work and its public, and they potentially allow the maker to rethink how the work is being circulated, received, or reused. He also makes a difference between the two different histories of this type of licensing. At the one hand, coming through art and activism, underground publishing, radical publishing, where the relation to copyleft always has been tense and been explicitly worked on. And on the other hand, the techno-legal, or as he says, a cybernetics strand that comes through software practice. In 2000, these energies came together, and this is how Constant somehow got involved. The type of license that the collective Constant has used for all its work since that moment, so 20 years, is a free art license that is a license of a type called that falls under the free culture definition. And whoever has been involved with free software at any point recognizes how close these are to the techno-legal strand that we saw on one side of Aymeric's slide. So this is from the free culture definition, which states that works of authorship should be free, and by freedom we mean the freedom to use the work and enjoy the benefits of using it. The freedom to study the work and to apply knowledge acquired from it. The freedom to make and redistribute copies, in whole or in part, of the information or expression. The freedom to make changes and improvements and to distribute derivative work. So this is the conditions under which the material that is produced in the constellation of Constant has been circulating for the last 20 years. So this is not about Constant, but just so you understand that I'm not talking about a music practice, although music is being made, operas are being written, songs are being performed, playlists are broadcast over radio. There's many other things that happen. So for the last, with the, you can see it's sometimes performative, sometimes more fine art, sometimes more about knowledge transfer, about technology, usually involving more than one person. And what started to happen is this almost intuitive connection to a set of conditions that to us were a way to express our feminist ideas about authorship started to have a big impact on the way we worked. We started to reconsider the tools that we were using to make our work. So for example, I brought a series of books that we published in the last years, and all these books have been not only released under licenses that fall under this free culture definition, but also they have been made with tools that fall under the same conditions. So they have been made with free software tools. They also use fonts, typefaces, that are available under the same conditions. So it means that we started to see how the conditions for tools, content, practice, not just the way our distribution was going, but also the way we actually were making things was radically changing. And as you can imagine, aesthetics were changing too. Or, for example, not wanting to use PowerPoint. So the other thing I wanted to show you is this year's budget. Because I think it's important to understand that Constant does not... the numbers fall off because of that. That was not on purpose. Is a partially funded organization. Our income comes through services, direct or indirect. So services to other organizations or companies, or the program we run is being funded as being valuable to Flemish, Belgian, or European culture. So that's a kind of service too. This means that we're not depending on the sales of individual objects. And that changes, of course, our relation to remuneration drastically. So I think that's important to understand when I talk about this. So 20 years into this practice, that in a way has worked very well for us. We are still standing as a collective. We employ the equivalent of 3 full-time people, which is, I find, still impressive. It's, of course, distributed over many, many hands, but here we are. There's a vibrant community around it. This type of conditions have had really a generative effect on the way we work. But still, in the last few years, we started to see certain problems appear that we decided to face in this in these months. So one of the big problems, I start with the second one, is that because of its linking to conventional copyrights, even when the conditions are created for collective practice, individual authorship is re-inscribed again and again and again. So it's very difficult to actually support collective practices. And one of the problems that it comes up with, and this is very real, not an exotic or philosophical problem, is that because of our work that is somehow between the creation of tools, infrastructures, artworks, it is very clear that tools, for example, are somehow part of this collective authorship. And free licenses give us no tools whatsoever, no thinking tools, to think authorship beyond human subjects. The second problem is, and we've heard it in different ways, but is, of course, the linkage of authorship always to property. This means that the cultural production is seen as essentially as something that can be, as a resource that can be transferred, that can be sold, that can be dispossessed. And this becomes extra painful now, seeing how, especially in the context of platform capitalism, the use of free licenses is very much supported as a way actually to lower the barrier to circulation of goods created for free by artists. And this is obviously not the type of economy we wanted to support. And then the third problem that comes up is that, and it is linked, of course, to the individual author being still so central, is that we're still focusing on product, not process. So while the practice actually is very clear in with feminist politics, with a clear investment in collective practice, doesn't have a problem to recognize a product, the licensing conditions actually stay with the product all the time. So this shift in, let's say, the seeing more the problems than the advantages is obviously has to do with the changing technological conditions, maybe also with the sharpening of queer activism within Constant that poses other questions to authorship and collectivity, anti-colonial activism and thinking that gets much more to the surface. Because, and again, we have heard some references to this also, none of the free licenses actually offers any opening towards less privileged forms of authorship or assumes that authors are entitled, like feel and are entitled as subjects to the law to actually donate the freedom to others. So this colonial move that is somehow baked into copyright is perpetuated in free licenses. So we decided to try and reimagine copyleft. Again, throughout this afternoon, I've been asking myself whether that is actually a clever move, because obviously it comes from the decision to stay with the trouble of a project that we have that is very much baked into our ecology, that is part of our politics, that is very much part of the fabric. Has become very much part of the fabric of Constant. And then to start questioning it is already hard enough. To abandon it is almost difficult to imagine. Something else that is... the question is, of course, by staying with copyleft, that ultimately is always depending on existing copyright, we might run into the limits of... what we can do through a license, which is in a way a contracting move. But on the other hand, as Emmerich already mentioned, it is also a way through documents and protocols, through the grey literature that we work with and work from, to start rethinking the legal and legal conditions for authorship that we're interested in. So for now, we stay with this affirmative critique. So at the at this study day, we invited four speakers, and I'll just give you a little flavor of the kinds of inputs they brought. The first guest we invited to give us input was Eva Weinmeier, who came with a contribution on what she called situated authorship. She is a feminist editor, runs a project called the Piracy Library, is interested in citational politics and how citation always prefers certain authors over others. I start with a quote she brought to the meeting. Not of herself, but of Christopher Kelty, who's been thinking about recursive publics in trying to understand what drives free culture software development. And he writes something that I think is interesting to bring into this room. Perhaps it's not the case that merit derives solely from the content of utterances freely and openly circulated, so... works, but also from the ways in which they are uttered, and the dignity of the people who utter them. an open access or free software that embraced that principle would demand that we pay attention to different problems. How are platforms, infrastructures, tools organized and built to support not just the circulation of putatively true statements, but the ability to say them in situated and particular ways, with respect for the dignity of who is saying them and with the freedom to explore the limits of that kind of liberalism, should we be so lucky to achieve it? So he's calling attention not just for what circulates, and but in what situations and in what way those works get contextualized.
So this iceberg shows the big...
Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. Part of this PowerPoint issue is that I cannot go back. So I will not only... pretend I am with Anne, I'm also pretending Eva is here. What she's trying to talk about in this meeting was the iceberg of authorship, or author practice, as she calls it. So she showed this drawing where she says, usually only the top part gets recognized as authorship, but there's way more. She was referring to collective practices of organizing where the speaker maybe might get recognized on the program, but everything else that is going on in order to make this utterance possible is considered non-authorship. And so from, like, as a political standpoint, she is trying to call for another type of authorship that would not be seen as output, as producing work, but as input. So what would it mean if we would say authorship or author practice is generative, is an input to something else to happen? If we do that, then actually the whole geometry shifts. The second a guest was Daniel Blanga-Goubet, who was talking about circulating authorship. His work was he's working as a curator and a performer, amongst others, in Kunstfestival Les Arts in Brussels, a large international arts festival, performing arts festival that happens every year. And recently they have changed the direction of the festival into a collective. So there's three people running it, which means that the artistic direction and financial or managerial direction start to blend. And we were interested in his understanding of authorship coming from that. I hope I have not made...
And Ibn Rushd is a very prominent figure and very common reading in Arabic-speaking communities. And I remember that back then I was very interested by a specific text or when I read about in a comment that Ibn Rushd did of the Anima of Aristotle, he speaks about the collective intellect. And he argues that there is only one single human capacity for human knowledge, and it's the idea of a kind of common intellect, which is one and the same for all human beings. So this intellect is eternal and continuously thinking about all that can be thought. Sometimes it refers to as a kind of cloud that thinks beyond the human being. But what was interesting for me is that in one passage, Ibn Rushd explained that the intellect, so these entities, uses faculties, human faculties, such as the brain of individual human, as a basis for its thinking process. So we are not thinking, but it's the intellect that thinks through our brains.
So he uses a story from a Muslim philosopher Ibn Rushd, writing in the 12th century about the general intellect. And he used that as a way to talk about authorship as a form of use of the general intellect rather than a production or a contribution to it. And again, shifting the direction of where authorship goes. For him, authorship or authored works are not a property, are not about property, but about use. And in that way, he could make space for other types of authors that are possibly not human. The third speaker was a lawyer. Séverine de Soyer joined Constante exactly at that moment when we were starting to introduce copyleft to our daily practice. And she was the lead for Creative Commons for many years in Belgium. Currently, she's working in Paris as an intellectual property lawyer on a project she calls, well, she calls it inclusive copyright, but we renamed it for the occasion into inclusive copyleft. There she is. Her move is quite deceptively simple. Her argument is that the connection to property, the problem is not so much that it's a connection to property, but that it's a connection to exclusive property. So what if we would replace that concept of exclusive property, like I have something, so then you cannot have it, by something called inclusive property. And this is apparently a legal category that's being worked on in relation to, for example, collective housing, but also in relation to projects such as Wikipedia that struggle with current copyright, but actually also struggle with the free licenses that are being applied to it. Already in 2006, she made an important critique of copyleft regime, the specific one, Creative Commons. And she used Audre Lorde's famous phrase, "You cannot dismantle the master's house with the master's tools," to talk about how somehow something much more radical needed to happen. And she wrote, "In the creator's search for a way to formalize their desire to share and spread their knowledge, information or creations, Creative Commons is a useful option. But the change of social practice in copyright will not be achieved without an in-depth consideration of the economy of culture and the conditions for artistic practices. There is a risk that if Creative Commons does not start to reflect on the cultural aspects of its ideology, it will harm artistic creation in a way that it has not foreseen. By assigning to creators the role that the consumers and some industries would like them to assume, Creative Commons would play the game of such new masters in copyright law." So, and basically, she was foreseeing how Creative Commons would play into the hands of platform capitalism. So she has her 2019 critique on Creative Commons and copyleft is that it's useful and necessary in the copyright toolbox. But, and this is something we did not discuss too much, it does not care about remuneration of artists. It does not capture collaborative creation, which is interesting because on the surface you would think that it's exactly made for this. It does. It relies on default exclusive copyright and contract rules, and therefore reinforces a limited authorship model. So the problems we are having with authorship being individualized, humanized, and having. Is actually, she says, stays with alternative models such as Creative Commons. So she proposes inclusive copyleft that would try to find a way to, and in a nice way she was resonating the iceberg of Eva Weinmeier, that would acknowledge authors and contributors, but not by making everyone an author. So just to, like, for an anecdote, problems that are appearing in Wikipedia is where there's thousands of authors on a page sometimes. Sometimes someone has just added a dot or corrected a spelling mistake. And in this, in the legal regime that Wikipedia operates under, all these people have to be considered as authors. There's no separation between the types of authorship. So she's not saying they people that put correct spelling mistakes should not be recognized, but they should not also not all be authors. So we need to think about different ways of contribution, contributing to a collective work. Then again, like she's trying to think about the collaborative process beyond authorship. So authorship is not the only way that collaborative works are going through. So there's many, many more processes that need to somehow be looked at. And then her final proposal is to attach the right to use not to the license. She starts talking about licensors, so people that give the right, but should be related to the work itself. So, and in that sense, she's almost bringing back the collective intellect that Danielle was bringing up. The work has its own rights, separate or in relation to its authors, but not inalienable connected. And in that sense, it's quite different from the types of proposals we have heard today. So actually to find ways that the work itself could somehow come with rights and possibly obligations. The last one was Aymeric Monceau. You have already heard him in the beginning, who was trying to make a historical overview of how we ended up here. What has had happened for us to find ourselves in critiquing and opening up a project that all of us have a great respect and commitment to. And this is what he
said. That sometimes when software is being developed, when something goes wrong, it's called a regression, and then people are working hard to make sure you revert the changes so then you can fix things. And I think that with free culture, it's a clear regression what happened. It doesn't mean that what has been left behind is the final, let's say, solution or final aim, but it was, let's say, a means to try to discuss this quite complicated topic, and now it became an end, and that's a regressive position that needs to be essentially reverted. Because I do think that now what we have in the context of free culture is not this sort of vision of a pluralism of hegemonies, which was what was attempted in this sort of mid 90s, late 90s. But we have a very narrow echo of the same type of politics and the same type of ideology that are basically became the dominant voice for all sorts of discussion around free open source software. And they became so dominant and so dogmatic that to talk about this now in public is really scary. Because
so what he's speaking about is how a discussion that was actually super vibrant in the beginning, because it was artists and rights holders and lawyers trying to figure out together what does copyright do to authorship and how could we think it different. And these licenses, these free culture licenses, were a way to somehow, were almost like manifestos as ways to try and express the politics of authorship. What has happened is that right now those licenses are basically solutions. They're means to an end, but the discussion around it has literally died down. And this is something we would like to come back to. So I give you a few examples of licenses that have started to appear in the last 2-3 years that do exactly this. None of them is a solution, and none of our friends' lawyers believes that they will hold in court, but they're interesting propositions to try and think again about what it is to be an author, why we do author work, and why we want it to circulate. So this license is a cut and paste of different statements trying to bring decolonial questioning into a copyleft license. It's a very odd mix, but it's interesting to how it tries to think through cultural appropriations and the problem and its problems, and not just the rights, but also the obligations of those that distribute their work. A second funny one is the non-white heterosexual male license. So it appeared, as you can imagine, in the environment of more and more explicit responses to sexual harassment. And it's a license that basically prefers non-white heterosexual males as users of the content. Okay, this is a more classic one. This is actually taking the free culture statements into economy, into communist economy. It comes from the environment of Telecommuniste and the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. It's very long. This is one published by Constant. We were working with fermentation and were worried about bacteria as authors. So we tried to imagine a license that would somehow include them into the production that was clearly going on. This is a proposal for a license which has never been written, but it's a group of software developers that want to add a license to a free software license to prevent anyone to use their software for environments that are not environmentally friendly. How you do this, I have no idea, but it's interesting to see is that the license becomes a way to think about. So the authorship becomes a way to think about these issues. The last one is well known by one of the speakers of tomorrow. It's called the Consumer's Dilemma license. It was inserted in a book on piracy. And it's basically proposing users of the material, depending on where they are from, to pay somewhere, I think, between, let's say, $10,000 and $15,000. And it's a way to somehow open up the discussion about inequalities and asymmetries in rights to use. For Constant, it went in another direction. We realized that to talk about authorship meant also to talk about the way we work, not just in the things we make, but also in how we connect with others, how we want to collaborate. And so it meant that instead of writing this, rewriting our copyleft licenses, we started to write orientations for collaboration, which obviously also include questions of licensing. But here you see our proposals on the windows of our office being commented on by people from the neighborhood. Because we understood that somehow we need to come to terms with the relation of authorship and the politics of our practice that goes a bit farther than copyright alone. So we started with something that other people might call a code of conduct that actually then draws in our licensing policies as well, because we think they're actually related. This is clearly not a quick work. It's something we started since this spring, and will slowly develop into a set of different protocols that will explain the limits of what we find acceptable in our spaces to how we want to deal with privacy or how we think our works can be changed. So the last slide is just to remind myself and you of why it could be interesting to be busy with the things so dull and gray as copyright and copyleft licenses. And so I invite my thinking partner and research companion, Jara Rocha from Barcelona, in an interview with Geraldine Juarez, where she says, this is how we can maybe understand gray matter or gray literature. A spot from where you can turn the very probable into quite possible. This is where things can be altered, precisely because this is the place where things can be written down, where things start tracing the two probable trajectories of the contemporary structuring of matter and can be somehow partly rewritten and changed from the probable to the possible in an instant. This is at least where the probable and the possible blur, they are both there. This is the space-time of transformation. Thank you very much. Right.
Any questions?
Hello, hi,
hello.
Bonjour. I just wanted to add a contribution about the relation of authorship and contributor, the difference and what could be done with that, and what is actually done in that in free software, in code. And because of the tools that the developer used, for tracking all the difference and all the change and all the movement in the evolution of the code, we have access to each part of each contributor. And so we can have rules. If you can change quickly all what one author I've done, we can say it's a contributor. And if you need to rebuild the whole software, it's because it was an author. The initial author or another one, because he have done a lot of that could, because I'm thinking of that saying, that could be a problem if the software during his life is rebuilt, because the initial author will maybe disappear because of the quality of the code, you can say. But anyway, I wanted to add that if you can change, it's a contributor. If it's difficult, it may be because it was an author.
No, it's in a way, in these systems, treat everyone that is logged in has an account, so already assumes that authorship means ability to make an account or necessity to make an account and make a contribution that way. So it creates a separation between certain kinds of contributions and others, very simply, and then treats every contributor as an author. So there's no separation between the types of contributions you make. So this is why you get in a larger and older project. I'm just using Wikipedia now, but it's the same for software projects. You get very long lists of authors that each have full rights on the project. So they need to consent with what happens to a software object or a Wikipedia page, either through the license they sign or through additional consent. And this creates big problems in how material is in practice being shared, especially in the long term. And this is the kinds of issues that Severin is trying to work on with inclusive copyleft. So, yeah, I mean, you can, yeah, of course you can always fork, so you can start your own project. It is about when you want to keep things together, and then these kind of issues start to appear. Question there.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm wondering a little bit about a slide. I know, I think you can't go back to it, but it was basically about what you can do with the work. And I was wondering, is that, as opposed to what you can't do with it?
You mean the free culture definition?
Yeah, free culture. So
let's see. You know,
I was wondering how much is that a feminist perspective? To describe something by in terms of what you can, I would sort of think that.
Yeah. So when we talk about licensing,
what you can do should be implicit.
What happens usually is that,
that
it's presented in a very
an author from
yeah very
kind of abuse.
It's a mechanical way, like you know, it's straightforward. You've got something,
people steal work
and
them,
you
so.
Put a license next to it. And then this is it. And then according to the license, then this thing is able to circulate in some way or another.
Describe
that's true. And it's like more belong to the legal aspect of this mechanism. But at the same time, these licenses, at least for me, something that is as important is to see that as being basically ideological interfaces. And they are ideological interfaces because they allow a work or an author or a creator or a collective to basically establish a relation between their practice and society. That's step one. But step two, because of the document itself and the way they articulate the condition of circulation, they are also able to share how they envision the transformation of society. So in the end, it's essentially like dealing with politics. So any kind of license, regardless of you know like its dryness or its, let's say, its more speculative, artistic dimension or activist dimension, is a political element.
That's exactly what we're trying to think about right now. But there's a necessity to do it, because if not, then a work falls under the restrictions of conventional copyright, which means that you always have to ask permission. You have no right to distribute, to remake, to share. And so in that sense, the statement of the freedoms is essential, is necessary. What it also does is that it puts a spotlight on or pays attention to the relation between making and studying, for example, or genealogies. And not in a way, this statement in the feminist interpretation talks about how authorship there is maybe no tabula rasa, there's maybe no original author. These authorship practices are webbed by definition in the sense that they make use of the ecologies of work that are around, even if we talk about language. So for us it was important, we committed to it because it somehow made explicit or articulated this position within authorship.